Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Please subscribe to our series on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm pleased to welcome Eva Illouz to the show today to talk about her new book, The End of Love, A Sociology of Negative Relations. Professor Eva Illouz holds the Rose Isaac Chair in Sociology at the Hebrew University and the School for Advanced Studies and the Social Sciences in Paris. She's also a senior research fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. Eva Illouz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Renee. I'm very happy to be here.
Before we begin talking about your book, tell us a little bit about yourself. Was there a person or an event or idea that was particularly instrumental in your intellectual development?
Oh, well, there would be quite a few of them. If you're talking about dead people, then I would say probably Max Weber, this great German sociologist, has had the greatest influence on my thinking, since he was the one who thought the most about the nature of modernity and what it meant to be moving toward a world that was becoming increasingly rational and impersonal in his perspective. Interestingly enough, he thought that this would lead to an increase, an accentuation of the erotic bond, what he called the erotic bond. If you're talking about living people, then it would have to be a philosophy teacher I had in France in high school. And she was extremely important in making me understand how the life of ideas could really influence, you know, how we live and how we think. So these are, I would say, perhaps the two people who influenced me most.
Well, the ideas you have in The End of Love are very powerful and interesting. The title is A Sociology of Negative Relations. What are negative relations?
Negative relations is a concept I have tried to elaborate in order to account for the fact that so many relationships actually end, sometimes quite quickly after they start, and sometimes because they never even start. So the word negative does not have the meaning we usually lend to it. It's not negative in the sense that it's simply not positive, not having, you know, a positive outlook. It's negative in the sense that it is indeterminate, that it is uncertain. That was one of the big meaning I gave to negative. Negative in the same way that, you know, somebody is looking for someone who is not in a very busy room. That's Sartre example to explain one of the properties of consciousness. You know, you missed a meeting, you go into a busy room, and that person is not there, and you're looking for that person. And so you're looking for an empty space, for an empty entity. And then the second meaning is another meaning which I took also from the existentialist tradition, only before Sartre. And it is the meaning of something that breaks down, and to which we pay attention to. Heidegger has this famous example of a hammer and a nail. And you can nail your, with the hammer, you can do that ordinary operation. But at some point, you know, maybe the hammer is going to break down. As soon as it breaks down, you pay attention to the hammer and or to the nail, whatever the reason is. And so negative means also it's a kind of relationship we're constantly thinking about and observing because they're not quite properly working. So what really interested me in this book is applying the notion of uncertainty as a sociological notion to the formation or the collapse or the end of sexual and romantic bonds. So that's why I felt the need to make up this notion of a negative bond to really account for this property of bonds that just don't stick together.
Well, many variables, many factors have been suggested as contributing to the unmaking of family and social bonds, for example, women's economic self-sufficiency, culture of hyper-individualism, the decline in the value of duty, national, family, religious, and as well as others. But you approach it through the lens of capitalism. Tell us why.
All the reasons you evoked are not untrue. They do play a significant factor. One of the main threads I have followed through in my research since I started it 30 years ago was to posit that the development of consumer culture and capitalism had an influence and even a significant influence on emotional life. So let me answer your question first of all on a broad level, and then I will try to tackle it on the more specific level that you raised here. You know, indirectly we can say that capitalism very much fostered the expansion of romantic love, for example, in enabling young people to have a living and therefore to be less dependent on their parents' guidance and prohibition to choose their mate. So we can say that in this indirect way, capitalism actually fostered romantic love. If you look at consumer culture, you also see that there was a very intense, I would say, use of the image of the romantic couple to promote goods. And since this is true already since the beginning of the 20th century, the image of the romantic couple is going to really haunt and be at the center of consumer culture. So that's a second element. Third element, we see also that romantic practices such as dating change under the impetus of consumer culture. Dating is actually a word that contains really two different types of meanings. It has the, let's say, emotional meaning or romantic or, you know, sexual meaning we want to attribute to it. And it also means that we're consuming something together most of the time. Dating means to go out on a date, usually means to consume something together. So it designates really a change in romantic practices and modes of encounter. So what this book is doing is to argue that the sexual revolution, which for women was a very important stage in their emancipation, that sexual revolution was completely hijacked by consumer culture. It was also made possible by it, by the way. But it was also hijacked by many aspects of consumer culture who entirely sexualized women's bodies and redefined the terms of the homosexual or heterosexual encounter. It redefined it in the sense that it progressively emphasized the sexual component and the sexual aspect of relationships. And in doing that, what it did is it made it autonomous. I mean, that's a sociological word to say that what happened is that, you know, sexuality for its own became a goal for its own sake. For its own sake, sorry. Mm-hmm. So you have the rise of a new form of encounter, which are called casual sex, which everybody calls casual sex. It's the hookup. It's the friends with benefits. You know, all these words come to express the fact that people meet for something which they expect to be very short-lived and which has actually no expectation of future. That, in my opinion, or as I try to show in the book, was very much shaped by consumer culture and in turn changed the terms of the encounter because it affected separation between emotions, between sexuality, and between the matrimonial goal. And that separation actually gave rise also to the uncertainty, especially in the beginning stages of relationships. And one of the things I try to show in the book is indeed that uncertainty is a very unusual characteristic of relationships. We usually know the rules and codes of most of our relationships. Practically the only relationships for which we have no codes and no rules are the ones that today are, you know, what we call romantic or sexual relationships. There is a close connection between this rise of uncertainty and the fact that sexuality has been so deeply and intensely promoted by consumer culture to refashion what it means to have a valuable self and what it means to enter into a relationship.
A recent article in The Atlantic, it's an American online magazine, had an article called "A Shift in American Family Values is Fueling Estrangement of Adult Children from Their Parents." And when I read that, although your book, of course, does focus on romantic relationships, I wondered whether that would fit into your sociological analysis as well.
Well, I don't know what the article says.
It's about an increasing incidence of estrangement of adult children from their parents.
Oh, this is the book by Joshua Coleman, isn't it?
Correct. Yes, yeah, it was okay. An article by him.
Yeah. Okay. You know, if you're asking if this feeds into my analysis, well, Joshua Coleman is a psychologist, if I'm not wrong.
Yes.
You know, I think I have tried to avoid terminology such as estrangement and alienation.
Yes.
Because these are too normative words. I'm trying really to try and understand what is happening, not to the family as such. There is a lot of literature to the family. I'm trying to understand what happens to encounters, mostly, although I do have one chapter on divorce. I think I would say that approaching another as if he was a stranger is different from estrangement. Estrangement happens between people who actually do know each other fairly intimately and are very familiar with each other. Whereas in my case, I would say it's almost the opposite that has interested me very much, which is the fact that there is a stranger whom you do not know, with whom you have a sexual relationships quite often relatively quickly, and who then again becomes a stranger who can most of the time who fades away from your life. So that strikes me as a different process than the one you are that Joshua Coleman is talking about of estrangement, because in his case it's really when children, you know, and parents become actively strangers, and it contains a lot of pain actually in it, whereas the process of going to bed with a stranger is often accompanied with a great deal of pleasure, often with a sense of empowerment, and often is accompanied by the sense that there is no goal to this, you know, casual, short-term relationship. Whereas in the first case, it is accompanied with a sense of failure, of something that has collapsed in the bond.
Okay, that explains a lot. Freedom generally is considered an absolute good. You write about negative freedom. What is that, and what are the problems with it?
So, you know, negative freedom is not my, I didn't coin that expression, and even though it may be confusing that the word negative freedom should seem to resonate with the notion of negative relationships, it's actually a bit different. So negative freedom, I think, was coined by Isaiah Berlin, and it's the kind of freedom that is supposed to regulate our relationships in under liberalism. Basically, it's the freedom to do whatever you want to do as long as you do not infringe upon another's freedom. In that sense, if you want, it's a thin notion of freedom. It doesn't tell you positively what you should do. It simply allows you to be whatever you want as long as it's not interfering with anybody else. Now, to this notion of negative freedom, we may oppose, say, two other notions. One is the notion of expressive freedom. I think it was coined by Günther Anders, a German philosopher. And expressive freedom is actually, it's not a positive one, even though the word is inviting. It's actually, for him, he wanted to say that there is increasingly in modern society a way of expressing yourself, a way of acting in the world that was increasingly narcissistic and unmindful of others, and that justified itself in the name of expressing yourself. And then there is a third notion, which was coined and worked on by the German philosopher Axel Honneth, which he called social freedom. It's a freedom in which I try to become, you know, an autonomous subject, but at the same time, I try also to do it in dialogue with someone else, which requires a special kind of social skill and a special kind of moral consciousness and moral development. So I think one of the issues that troubled me in this book was to ask the question of, you know, if I go back to the issue of sexual freedom, which I evoked earlier, sexual freedom was very important for women. But then that freedom enabled, I think, quite often sexual and romantic relationships to become the ground for people to do anything they want and to be a kind of site for self-expression, for the kind of expressive, self-assertive freedom that Günther Anders thought was actually destructive of relationships. So for me, I think that sexual and romantic relationships, we can see these three forms of freedom competing with each other. And one of my claims is that because we have been so preoccupied with, in a way, both negative and self-assertive freedom, we have not asked enough what we owe each other, in fact, and what should be the limits what should be our moral and ethical limits in a relationship. I illustrate this with the phenomenon of ghosting. Ghosting is increasingly common. Ghosting is when you have a relationship of whatever length with someone and that person simply disappears without often giving an explanation or announcing their departure. It often traumatizes the people who are left. So a great deal of those experiences of heartbreak, of abandonment, of desertion, are dealt with and discussed in psychologist offices. And one of the things I'm trying to do is to say, as a sociologist, this is called a quite widespread phenomenon. It is something that many women have to experience. It's actually quite often women, although I'm aware that there are some men as well. And most often people are on their own. They go to the psychologist to face and overcome and process the kind of pain that they may feel. This kind of pain is social. I want to say it is social, and it should be discussed again in ethical terms. I mean, we should take that pain seriously. Heartbreak is actually, or being left, or divorce is one of the major reasons why people commit suicide. It's the reason why people fall into depression. It is actually the source of collective pain. So as such, in discussing different notions of freedom, I wanted to reopen the discussion of what should be done to alleviate or discuss more collectively about this form about the collapse of freedom, which the French sociologist Émile Durkheim called anomie. Anomia was for Durkheim those social phenomena in which there were no more rules. And as a result of that, he observed that there would be an increase of suicide. And he connected the two of them. So I think romantic and sexual relationships have become the site for anomia, lack of rules, and trying to understand the fine line between freedom, the kind of freedom we want to keep. And anomia is one of the stakes of this book. This is the kind of conversation I would like to generate.
And even on a much more superficial level, ghosting is a lack of basic consideration, saying hello, saying goodbye, sort of the politeness and social norms people used to take for granted are eliminated in romantic relationships when there's ghosting. So, go ahead.
Sorry, was this a question?
No, it was just a comment, but please think.
I wanted to say, we should not forget that Master Ghoster was Don Juan of Mozart and Molière. So the ghoster is not as such a modern figure, but in contradistinction to Mozart to Molière, to that character, I mean, ghosting women comes with a very, very heavy price. If you ghost women, and this is what Don Juan does, in fact, if you ghost women, you are contravening to moral order, to a moral and religious order, because he abandons them, he has sexual relationships with them, and this is viewed as, exploitation and contravening the religious rules of the time, and he has to die at the end. So we have become a society of ghosters because there are no more penalties to be paid. And one of the things that struck me is how elaborate our sense of ethics has become on matters such as eating vegan, making sure we buy products from companies that produce their products in an ethical way, making sure our coffee is ethical. We have become ethically very developed in that respect. And yet, sometimes it's the same people who can behave as if the person they had a relationship with and sex with, as if that person had, if you want, no personhood that we should take into account when acting upon our simple desire to leave. So that's a paradox, if you want, of current morality that I think is worth thinking about and pondering.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's a very good point. And one thing it makes me think of is the examples you use where we're ethically developed are all either inanimate objects or things that impact people very far away whom we don't know. But what you write about is ethics toward people we are intimate with. And that, of course, is much more challenging. You write that sociology either is or can be the study of crisis and uncertainty. Say something more about that.
Well, traditionally, I think sociology has studied sturdy things, marriage, capitalism, bureaucracy, even suicide. I mean, each one of these would refer to a big sociologist, you know, Marx or Weber or Durkheim. Even divorce is a sturdy fact, what I would call a sturdy fact. It's a fact that is that is marked in the law, and it's very clearly defined. What I was trying to do in this book is to capture something that we have less concepts for, which is the fact that when people enter relationships, they often don't know, first of all, in what frame they are. Frame is a word to designate the kind of relationships we are in. Very often, we don't know if we are in a relationship, if we are in a situationship, if we are in a casual relationship. We simply don't know. It's quite extraordinary that would be the case, given that most of the time we always know in which kind of relationship we are. Then second, what interested me in uncertainty was that in contradistinction to traditional courtship, to the ways in which men and women, so heterosexual relationships were defined by encounters were defined by a very elaborate set of codes and rules that enabled men and women who had very scripted gender roles, it enabled them to know what to do and to handle, I would say, the uncertainty that sometimes accompany the revelation of feelings. Courtship as such has completely disappeared from our culture, among other reasons because sex is supposed to be at the beginning of a relationship. And with that, it means also that these relationships are now plagued by the problem of figuring the rules and the right sequence of events. So, you know, a lot of the people I interviewed, because I interviewed people as well as read popular culture for that, would tell you that they simply don't know what it means when a man or when a woman does that. And quite often I think it is women who are more perplexed by men's behavior. When a man does that, I don't know what it means. So I was interested in that kind of hermeneutic perplexity that seems to plague the condition of many women, and which also is at the heart of a very vast industry of self-help, of self-help books and workshops to help women, men and women, but mostly women, to figure out what it means and when, what to do. If you remember, there was a highly, highly successful book, I think it was about 20 years ago, called He's Just Not That Into You. And it was a very successful book because, you know, the book simply said, don't agonize. If you're asking yourself what it means or what he wants, it means he's just not that into you. And so it came as a strike in the clear blue sky, because so much of self-help culture aimed to help women to understand what the man was about. So one of the threads also I explore in the book is showing that this state of uncertainty is actually a way to reproduce gender inequality, because quite often it is women, more often than the men, women who are left to struggle with that state of hermeneutic uncertainty and perplexity. So in a way, sexual and romantic relationships are a battleground, if you want, for the difference between the sexes, but not only their differences, also for the relations of domination and power between the sexes. And uncertainty is also one manifestation of that.
And is that uncertainty related to what you write? And I quote, thick normativity, let's see, after the 1970s, the sexual revolution freed sex and romance from the so-called, quote, thick normativity by introducing a thin procedural one. Is that the source of the uncertainty you're talking about?
I'm not sure it's the source, but I would say it's connected. So what I mean by that is that thick normativity means that sexuality was connected to hot symbols and meanings. It was connected, for example, to sin. You know, the story of Adam and Eve is supposed to express also something about them discovering the sinfulness of their nakedness. I mean, certainly in what is called Judeo-Christian culture, sex is replete with heavy moral meaning. That's what I call thick normativity. And it tells you what's wrong and what's right. That's why also Don Juan is punished by God himself. I mean, you know,
right.
An expression of God himself. It's the commander, the statue of the commander, but it's really a divine punishment. So that just goes to show you how important sexuality is in this culture. We have moved, thanks to sexual revolution, we have moved to a culture which does not stigmatize or tries less to stigmatize sexuality, especially that of women. I mean, women, you know, were defined by their sexual purity and chastity, and in some culture, still, for some women to lose their chastity and purity is thought to be a kind of irreparable sin that you can commit, and a stain on the whole family as well. So, for me at least, mercifully, we have moved away from that vision of sexuality. We have moved to a vision in which consent now is going to play the main moral role. I would say that while in the past we put the onus of morality on the sexual behavior of women, and of men too, but less so, much less so, today we define morality more in procedural terms, in the sense that it has to follow the rules of consent. And it has to follow the rules of consent of two parties, because we have come to first understand that a great deal of male sexuality was predatory, it was violent, and it was based on violation of women's body. And also we have come to view men and women as equally autonomous subjects, and we have come to view, therefore, sexuality as something that must be actively consented to. But it doesn't tell you what you should consent to. So consent in itself is a very thin moral form, because it's as if you were supposed to, you know, resolve all the problems of domination as soon as you resolve the problem of consent. But actually, in my opinion, this is only a very small part of the problem of domination in men and women's relationships. So you can follow the rules of consent and yet still be in a relationship of domination. But this part of the relationship cannot be easily contracted. You cannot really say very clearly how to subscribe to, how to write a full contract, a full emotional contract. So on the one hand, we tend to think more and more of our relationships as contracts, which are freely entered and freely exited. But I think it's a wrong metaphor, because quite often we really have no way of knowing what contract to write. That's why I think it's a very thin way of conceiving of relationships.
In addition to the contractual consent issue, you write extensively, Eva, and quite graphically about the performative nature of modern sexual encounters. Why do you believe they add to the culture of uncertainty and confusion?
I'm sorry, Renee, I didn't hear you well.
the performative nature of modern sexual encounters. Write very clearly and very graphically about them. So tell us why you believe that that performative nature adds to the culture of uncertainty and confusion.
So first of all, I don't think it's me writing graphically. These are the examples I use, which are some of which are graphic. Well,
right. The subjects described it graphically.
Right.
Right.
So I think, you know, well, I don't want to sound nostalgic of an era in which things were clear. I just want to make that clear. I think we are, our culture is changing an enormous amount of rules and norms which concern both gender relationships and sexuality. And this profound change has entailed also uncertainty in the ordinary sense of not exactly, not having figured out the ground rules for this change. So my book wants to help the discussion in trying to figure out what these rules could be. And so this is simply a kind of caveat to before I respond to your question. I'm not nostalgic at all about the clarity which the past provided, because past relationships were marred with an unbearable, for me, with unbearable control and prohibitions on men's and women's bodies and sexuality. Now, with regard to your question, in what sense does contemporary sexuality contribute to increased uncertainty? I think it has to do mostly with the phenomenon I mentioned before. If in traditional societies you have three forms of interaction that are deeply intertwined, sexual, the emotional, and the matrimonial. And I'm using here an ideal type. If you take this, then we have increasingly separated all three of them. And we have separated them because because sexuality has become the object of politics of equality and emancipation. Sexuality has become politicized, political, which it always was, but it became explicitly so. At the same time that this process happens, sexuality is intensively used by movies, Hollywood, advertising, fashion, cosmetics, in a different sense, in the sense that in order to promote all these consumer items, you want the body to be redefined as a sexual one. And so this will contribute a great deal to, for example, redefine, I think, and interestingly so, women as mostly sexual objects. So you have this paradox of women, on the one hand, having more rights, having more equality, on the one hand, and on the other hand, becoming much more sexualized, and therefore also, in a way, kept in a situation where their difference from men is much more marked, or is very marked, or still very marked through their sexualized body. So these things actually will make a great deal of relationships that are sexual, uncertain in the sense that you don't know if they have any meaning that is other than sexual. Women and men also often enter these relationships with different assumptions. The stereotype according to which men want sex and women want are more ready for emotional relationships is actually something I found to be astonishingly true. Quite often stereotypes are not true. This one is much more true than I had anticipated or expected. So the approach of relationship that men between men and women is different. Women will tend to approach relationships as emotional things to care for. Men will tend to approach these relationships as occasions for sexual satisfaction. So these, in a way, accentuate also the differences between men and women. These differences are played out in these encounters and increase uncertainty.
I'd like to get back for a moment to something you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, and that was breakups and divorce with their very serious consequences, emotional, sometimes physical, life-threatening consequences. And we know that it's very well documented that that is the case. And nevertheless, a typical recent online article was entitled Afraid of Divorce, 15 Reasons Not to Be. Can you help us understand the disconnect between the real-life impact of divorce and breakups and the rather cavalier way popular culture deals with it?
You know, well, divorce was highly stigmatized. And it's no longer, I think. So one of the reasons why it's no longer stigmatized is for a good reason. People used to remain married even though they were deeply unhappy. In some countries, European countries, until recently, divorce was not allowed. So having the possibility to leave is an important prerogative of our rights, in the same way that people fought for the right to marry someone of their choice in the 19th century. That was a struggle. I would say in the 20th century, that was the struggle of the 20th century, was to the right to leave somebody we did not want to live with or could not live with. Think, for example, of a violent husband. Having said that, I would say that moral progress, that moral and legal progress, hides the fact that divorce will often be accompanied more again for women than for men with economic hardship and with the tremendous difficulties that can be felt in having one's self been rejected. So one of the things that characterize modernity very much is that our sense of self-worth is very much tied to our intimate relationships, much more so, I believe, than in the traditional world, in which one's self-worth was more given by your, you know, kin and your family status than by your intimate relationships. intimate relationships have become a major source of self-worth. When relationships end, that sense of worth and even identity, it's more than worth, it's also, it's more deeply identity. It's because intimate relationships today define the entire spectrum of who you are. It is who you spend your leisure time with. It is who you have sexual pleasure with. It is who you share your friends with. In a way, intimacy has become bound with the entire constitution of the self. So divorce means both a material, material downgrading of your life and severe undermining of your identity and your sense of self-worth. That, I think, are the sociological reasons why divorce is a much more difficult experience than it is often presented. Now, if you ask me in the other part of your question, why is divorce presented often in popular culture as something you should desire, I think there is a great deal of glibness in self-help culture, which offers programs, incessant programs of self-improvement, self-empowerment, and views divorce as just one step in that great project of remaking, constant remaking and reholding and re-empowering of the self. I think that's how I would interpret the reason why there is such an abyss between the real experience of divorce and the ways in which it might be presented in popular culture.
And finally, your book, Diagnosis, if you don't mind that word, our cultural pathology that may actually threaten the continued viability of the culture itself, in which so many people choose not to have children. Now that you've described the sickness, what are your thoughts about the cure?
Oh, you know, I'm not, as I said before, I don't think very much in normative terms. I try not to think about cures because, in my opinion, this is not the task of the sociologist. The task
no, that's true.
The sociologist is really to bring problems at the threshold of civil society and have people discuss these cures. So one could say, I mean, I think conservatives would say we need to emphasize what is called family values. I don't think we can really go back to family values. And I don't think it's also desirable, given that these family values quite often mean that the woman is in charge of running the domestic household and that this comes at the price of her own, of the development of her own personhood. So that's not an option. So I'm not sure I can tell you the cure. I think I can tell you what I would not want. Another possibility would be to kind of abandon the whole project of having a stable couplehood. And some people, you know, I mean, are doing this, some young people, a lot of young people are either living in polyamorous arrangement, or more and more, I want to say, more and more young people, or renouncing intimacy altogether because they find it all too complicated. That these two arrangements aren't very convincing to me. Because I do think that intimate, stable relationships and the experience of stubbornly loving someone through thick and thin is deeply formative for the character of a person, and is one of the ways in which we do learn to be more ethical human beings. So I don't think we should abandon. What I think should be, I mean, one of the keys, not all of them, for me, would be to insist that equality between the sexes is key to intimacy. And I think all too often, heterosexual relations are plagued by problems which seem to be the result of psychology when in fact they are the result of sociology. And one of them, not all of them, but I think one of them is inequality. So if I had to say what would be the core of or the direction of the cure I would use would be to rebuild relationships between the sexes on the basis of a deeper equality. It seems to me that that would be the only way to start rethinking the rules of engagement and disengagement also between the sexes. Thank you very much.
Ava, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thanks for coming on the show today and for your thought-provoking book, The End of Love, A Sociology of Negative Relations.
Thank you so much, Renee, for your very challenging and very thoughtful questions. It was a pleasure to be here.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.